Good evening, I am Josh Beiser, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Tonight, my topic is going to be talking Invisible Ink. This is the latest game from Clay Entertainment, who have really been on a roll for the last few years with hits like Mark of the Ninja, Don't Starve, and they've also really taken to Early Access, which is going to be a part of this conversation. So, to help me tonight and discuss the development behind Invisible Ink, please welcome from Clay Entertainment, Jason Dreger and James Lance.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, Jason and James. It's a pleasure to have you guys on.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much.
Before we get started with our discussion, I just definitely want to give you guys and the rest of Clay a shout out for Invisible Ink. I've been enjoying it. A lot of my friends are. And so far, I've been seeing overall good impressions from it on Steam.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So we're going to skip talking about the introductions of the studio, What's Behind Clay, because I actually had on, I think it was Nels Anderson back when Don't Starve came out. So he talked a little bit about how Clay was formed there. But since this is both of your first time on the cast, well, would you mind just talking a little bit about yourself and your background and position at Clay?
Sure. I came into the game industry. I went to school for a year in game design. And after that, got hired at Clay. I was working as a level designer on Shank 2. And then after that, I became one of Nell's lackeys and working on Mark the Ninja. So after Mark the Ninja, we started another project, which was going to be sort of Syndicate-esque. And I started doing a pre-production on that and became Invisible Ink.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm also a technical designer at Clay Entertainment. We're both technical designers of Invisible Ink. I was hired, like, I don't know, 2.5 years ago at this point to work on Invisible. And so I've basically, you know, just worked on Invisible since near the beginning. And before that, I was working at a Loot Drop, which is a company in San Mateo, California. Mm-hmm. And I went to school for 4 years studying programming and game design.
Cool. Now, just to clarify for people listening, what were both of your roles on Invisible Ink?
Yes, we were both technical designers. So we were basically the two designers in the project for most of the project's life span. And then Jamie was also a designer, major designer on the project.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So we're going to start talking about Invisible Ink itself. For this part of the cast, for people who haven't heard too much about Invisible Ink yet, I know the game, by the time this cast is actually up and people are listening to it, Invisible Ink will be out for about a week or so out of Early Access. So for people who haven't heard the game yet, what is, I guess, the general pitch or like the elevator pitch of what Invisible Ink is?
Sure, yeah. You are an operator commanding a team of elite super spies in a sort of cyberpunk future, and you're sending them into these like most secure complexes in the world to build up your team to survive that your agency's been destroyed and you're trying to recover from the ashes.
Yep, and it's a tactical espionage game, so it's a turn-based strategy, procedural, procedurally generated levels, and you know, it's all about kind of tactics, sneaking around, gathering information, creating a plan, executing, and getting out unscathed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's definitely a challenging game, and a part of it has to do with a lot of the tactical and stealth design, which we will definitely be talking about more in a few minutes. Now, as you guys were just saying a few seconds ago, the original pitch or the original design of Invisible Ink was going for this Syndicate-type style game, and I remember seeing the early, like, footage that you guys put up about the game and how it has evolved from there. Now, in terms of how the game went from, I believe, wasn't it originally called Incognita when it was first pitched, like, wow,
yeah.
like
yeah.
2 years ago, I think?
Yeah.
What, I guess, led to sort of the change in development more towards, like, the cyberpunk-esque or the futuristic setting of the game?
You know, it was mostly mechanics-based. We decided that we wanted a bit more, like, leeway with the stuff we could do, and it kind of just, like, the stuff we ended up wanting from the mechanics of the game made more sense in a cyberpunk world than it did in a sort of, like, spy, like, James Bond world.
If you have a, you know, fantasy setting, you can get away with a lot by, you know, putting in, whereas in technology setting, if you just go like future science, then you can kind of, that's your magic.
Yeah. Also, we found that the cyberpunk theme fits pretty nicely with, sort of a dystopian future with corporations and stuff, and big fans of Neuromancer and stuff like that. So we wanted to sort of embrace some of the capitalism gone wrong tropes in cyberpunk fiction.
Cool. Now, in terms of the balance or the difficulty of the game, Invisible Ink definitely is on the higher end of the scale, especially with how every agent really only has one life or one hit where they get taken out. From the beginning, were you guys aiming for this very hardcore, very challenging experience with the game?
I'm a fan of hardcore games, so of that kind of a challenge. I think that in design, when you're playing, when you're playtesting and stuff, it's easy to keep making it harder to challenge yourself as a designer. So I think near the end, we realized that maybe we were making it too hard, mm-hmm. so we started adding in more features that would support earlier players. But because of the way the game was designed, that all the information is sort of there. There's not that much actual random stuff that once you know the systems, it is fairly easy, and that it's just more teaching people the systems that was the real problem.
And part of the balancing and fine tuning of Invisible Ink would have to be the campaign structure that you guys set, which is the 72 hours of in-game time to sort of prepare yourself for the final mission. What was the design decision behind building Invisible Ink around this sort of, it's I guess technically a linear campaign because you have this set time, but it's not linear in the sense that you have procedurally generated levels and you're given full reign to decide what missions you go on and where.
Yeah, so I mean, we always knew the game was going to be a roguelike like FTL or Splunky. Basically, that was the game from the very beginning. And, it was only later on that we really extended the campaign. So it actually, it was going to be like an hour and a half per play. Mm-hmm. It just got longer and longer. So now it's, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours maybe per play. But it's intended to be replayed. So it's totally inspired by Splunky and FTL and those kind of games. It's kind of always like we wanted to go with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, another part of the game that I think had some debates and was very interesting is the use of the Endless Mode for Invisible Ink. And it's quite interesting is the fact that the Endless Mode, one hand, really cuts around the whole idea of this campaign or the structure of 72 hours, but on the other hand, it does give you a lot more freedom in just seeing how far you guys can go with the game. With developing the Endless Mode functionality, was this something that you guys intended from the beginning, or did this sort of come about during the design phase?
I'd say it came out in the design phase.
Yeah, I agree.
Kind of maybe early-ish, but mm-hmm. it wasn't the first part of, like, it wasn't the piece we were designing around for sure.
Yeah, and basically, as we made the game, we got a better sense of what people wanted from this kind of game.
Yeah,
and a huge number of people wanted Endless Mode, and it doesn't really hurt the other people who don't want it for it to be there. So we were like, yeah, seems good.
People on the forums, like during the early access, were playing it a lot more than we thought they would. So,
also, Endless Modes have a long history in kind of roguelike games where, there is these infinite dungeons and those kind of things. So it kind of made sense with the way we structured our game.
All right. For both of you, do you guys prefer to play the game in the campaign mode or in the Endless Mode?
Play a super hard version of the campaign mode, basically.
I play campaign mode. I enjoy the build up for the climax and then having it end.
Yeah.
Being one of the designers, if I want to test out what like a perfect build of the agents is, I can just give my guys all the stuff. But generally, if I'm playing like an endless mode, is to see that perfect build, how it works, where I can mm-hmm. just give myself that. So to me, it's building up without being able to get perfect and beat the campaign.
Yeah.
Now going back to the balance of the game or the learning curve. How did you guys approach, I guess, the player's own ability to affect the environment? In this link for us right now, the player's means of getting around are either the stealth aspects of evasion, or they can try to engage guards very lightly. One of the major parts of the game, obviously, is you can't really kill the guards. You never have enough tools, or if you get enough tools, it's going to cost you so much in terms of resources to, quote-unquote, empty a level.
We wanted to make this a stealth game, mm-hmm. and earlier builds of it had sort of a combat element in it, as we were, you know, trying to find the verbs to give the players. A lot of them were still combat stuff. And it was always the case that if you have the choice of doing this sneaking stuff or the combat stuff just is always easier to go to. Mm-hmm. And we wanted it to be a stealth game. So we kept pulling that out, trying to push it more into stealth. So
it's also a lesson learned from Mark the Ninja.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you want to tighten the game up and make it like these core actions, then you have to take away the stuff that people are, you know, the kind of safety net for people, right? Of like, oh, well, I'm going to try to make it stealthy, but no big deal. If I don't get it right, then I'll just shoot everyone. Mm-hmm. That's what most stealth games are like. And we were like, yeah, I think we'd rather just have it like, you know, you have to learn how to be stealthy.
Yeah.
And you definitely do have to do that with Invisible Ink. I just put like a little video together. It was basically 13 minutes of me playing hide and seek at level 6 of the guards, like all storming after me with like elite enforcers. And it was just insane to try to get around that. And that actually takes me to another question regarding the mechanics. Where did the decision come in to have this sort of force escalation mechanic in the form of the alarm system? Which, for people who haven't played the game yet, you basically have 6 alarm states that every turn it fills up, and after every 5 turns normally, the level basically becomes a little harder. More cameras activate, firewalls go up, and then more and more guards start showing up.
That's our food, right?
Yeah, totally. So roguelikes, you know, the game was a roguelike from the beginning, and roguelikes have a lot of awesome design stuff to take from them in general, most games. And so when you're making a game that's like supposed to be like that, and you have to go back and look at those things and see like, okay, why did they do this, right? Like, what are these things? I'm not just going to like make a game that just does things for no reason and then call it a roguelike. You know, you have to actually go back and look at, why they put in the mechanics they did into like NetHack or Rogue or Broke or any of those games. Mm-hmm. So, one of the major things in roguelikes is hunger. And hunger is the thing that keeps you moving. It keeps you efficient. It makes sure that, you know, your resource decisions are interesting in roguelikes. Mm-hmm. And so the alarm levels are hunger, basically. You know, it's like one of the things we wanted to change from XCOM and those kind of turn-based strategy games is that, you know, we wanted to make sure the player was having to make interesting decisions about how they progressed their level and wasn't just progressing through the level because they were bored. Mm-hmm. You know, something that I found in XCOM was that I would often make stupid moves just because I was too lazy to make the good moves. I was like too lazy to like inch all my guys up behind cover over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I'd rather have people make that decision because it's interesting and not just because they're kind of bored. And they're like, okay, I'm just going to send all my guys all the way forward. So see if we trigger any aliens, you know, just because it's not super, it's too time consuming to do it the right way. So yeah, I mean, that was sort of the idea behind that.
So something I've noticed lots of people feel that it's intense or this high pressure that they maybe don't enjoy in the turn-based game. But I find that like most turn-based games that I've played, like Final Fantasy Tactics and things, they usually impose a 20 turn limit on most games anyway. So I guess the difference is it's sort of the escalation part of it is that each turn is getting a little harder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Makes it like a soft end, where in those games, after 20 turns, you just lose. Where in our game, it's harder. But you're not done yet.
Yeah. Now, speaking about giving the player interesting moves or decisions to make during a turn, another part of the game, as we've said, is the stealth aspect, and a major part of that is the cover mechanic, and basically getting your agents around the level. In terms of setting up the mechanics or what the player can do with their agents, did that go through any major design iterations or changes? Or in terms of the player's actions, did that remain relatively constant throughout the early development, early access, and into release?
As I was mentioning earlier, we had a lot of more combat mechanics in the earlier stages of the game. And so cover was just like cover in most like sort of tactic shooter games, where it's like making them harder to hit you. But when we made the change to go more sort of double down on the stealth, mm-hmm. the shooting became very binary. You were just hit or you weren't. And so that the cover mechanic became more you are seen or you're not. It's just sort of binary, like the damage became as well. So that did change.
And also the cover you might notice is very unrealistic. It's like basically it's sort of taking just a 90-degree angle off of it and then seeing if anyone's like behind you more or less to see you. But, you know, for a while we were considering doing it raycast, so you would actually, like, go over diagonals and stuff to see if people could see you. Like, you know, you'd actually take the guard, you take his head or body or whatever, the center of his tile, and raycast to the center of your tile and see if it lost any cover. But the problem with that is that then we were asking players to do raycasts in their head to see if they would get seen. And it was just a little bit, you know, unintuitive and weird, even though it was more realistic. So we ended up going with a sort of more unrealistic, sort of 90-degree angle cover.
Yeah, you can get the situation where your agent is, like, behind a box, and there's a guard, like, down a ways in the room. And so it would look like the guard could easily see your agent, but with our mechanics, it's you're behind the box, and he's not on that side of the box as you, so he can't see you. It's just a very easy rule of thumb to know whether you're going to be seen.
So it's unrealistic with players. You can intuitively understand whether or not you'll be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another part of that would have to be the UI design behind Invisible Ink. It is very streamlined, and it does give the player a lot of viable information. I know one of the exciting things that was added later into early access was more accurate readings on the guard detection, so you can see exactly where you're safe, where you're not, or wherever you run from, and he's just going to shoot you dead right then and there. In terms of building up the UI, how did you guys and the rest of Clay, or the rest of the team, approach, you know, how much information you wanted to give the player versus how much you're just going to basically let the player have to learn the game itself?
Did we have a rule of thumb for that?
Just endless iteration.
Yeah,
basically.
That
just,
was one of the hardest tasks.
And then getting someone into the office to play it, and then another pass, then getting a couple more people into the office, and another pass. Basically just, you know, iteration, and, you know, sort of taking what people would... We would have people play the game and then ask them to narrate their thoughts. And they would say, like, oh, I expected this button to be here. Or like, okay, let's put it there. And so we just sort of try to figure out what people intuitively thought was the UI was telling them. And then, you know, sort of match that to be like, okay, we're trying to make this UI as easy on human psychology as possible. Yeah. So just, you know, try to figure out, get people to tell us what they're thinking, and then try to match up what the UI looks like to what they'll intuitively understand it to mean.
Cool. Now, we talked a little bit a few minutes ago regarding the different modes or different ways to play Invisible Ink, and I just want to touch on one other part about that, and that is the different difficulty settings of the game. You have Normal, Experience, Expert, then you have the Plus variants. How did you guys decide on the different difficulty levels? And then taking that a step further, how did you decide on how you would modify or tweak those levels to make the game harder without making it, you know, super impossible difficult?
One of the things we wanted was we had the expert was what we had designed the game as, but the game had such a steep learning curve. People were, you know, were struggling against it. So we wanted to make a zone where they could play and sort of practice and learn the rules, and then, you know, level themselves up to play where we had designed the game. So the beginner level is kind of like extended tutorial. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want to remove all of the elements that they'd be playing within the experience, but we wanted to give them like lighter versions of it. So the alarm level, for example, it still exists in the beginner, but it ramps up slower. So that was one of the ways that we added in like the beginner for almost like an extended tutorial of the experience setting.
We also added in stuff like rewinds and level retries. We basically took the traditional save scumming in a turn-based game that you might do and made it part of the game experience rather than just sort of like pretending it's not there. So that we allow people to do some light save scumming, but then, you know, sort of like, okay, you know, gently remind them that they should, you know, they're out of rewinds, right? So you can't save scum anymore. So it's like, you know, we tried to make it, instead of being like this awkward thing where it's like, well, yeah, I beat the game, but it just saves going things, so it's kind of whatever, blah, blah. It's like, we were like, no, this is part of the game now. You're okay. You're fine. You can save scum, but just, you know, not that much. So
I think a lot of people that use the rewind are people that don't normally save scum anyways. It's just in this game, it's more of like they wanted to explore to see how something worked so that they would learn how that tool worked and they could use it properly in the future.
Right.
And they use the rewind as that.
Okay. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, how did you guys go about building the Expert Plus variants and when you push it all the way to the end of the difficulty curve?
So, I mean, one of the things about the game is that, you know, in a lot of games, the difficulty settings are sort of lazy. They just increase hit points and damage and whatever. It may make you take longer to kill the guy, so it's like, okay, we'll just tweak some numbers. But in our game, you actually can't do that. There's no numbers to tweak, really. So we had to go in very specifically and think about what made the game harder in an interesting way. One thing that interestingly didn't make the game harder in a good way was more guards. So our initial thought was, oh, maybe the harder difficulties just have more guards in them. But that sucks, basically, is what we found. Is if they have a lot more guards, like, they can have a little bit more guards, but if they have a lot more guards, then they just start to get really bad, and you clump everything everywhere, and everyone just, like, you know, every hallway has, like, three guards stuck in it, basically, so it's just a really dumb game. So we had to make the difficulty interesting, harder in a more interesting way, so we ended up going with, you know, the alarm levels up when you knock out guards, so that's, like, a little, kind of, it adds just texture to the decisions you're making. It makes it a little bit more difficult, but not straightforwardly so. So, yeah, I mean, you know, our game just sort of forced us to make interesting difficulty settings. I don't know. If we had hit points and damage counters, maybe we wouldn't have that difficulty.
It was interesting how I was just saying that adding just more guards, it wasn't that it made the game, like, more just impossible. You could still, it was hard. You could still get through it. It's just the strategies to get through the clumps of, like, three guards wasn't fun.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely an interesting conversation, one that's something that we definitely hear more about in strategy design, or just in overall game design in general, regarding how far do you push the difficulty. Because, as you guys were just saying, the common strategy is, let's just up HP, let's just up the number of the guards. And as you figure out from playtesting, it gets to that point where it's not making the game any more engaging, it just makes it more and more tedious.
Right.
And I see that a lot in action games, where just playing the game on the super hard difficulty level, you're not really challenging the player anymore. It just becomes this gauntlet of tedium of, oh, I gotta hit this guy now 30 more times instead of 10.
Right.
And
it's really like making your margins of error just smaller and smaller.
Exactly.
And smaller. Yeah.
And at that point, it just doesn't really become engaging anymore. It just becomes, okay, I now have to figure out the super exact razor thin build that's going to work. Anything else, I'm going to fail. And you just lose a lot of the experimentation, a lot of the high-level thinking that goes with playing the game.
I think one of the things that in our Expert Plus is we removed the in the game you have the ability to see rooms that are watched by the enemy. If you peek through a door, you can see in the ground that it's red, saying that there's, like, something is watching this room. Mm-hmm. Then you'll open the door and find out that, oh, sure enough, there's a security camera in the room watching the area. In our Expert Plus, we removed that so that you don't get this, like, advanced knowledge of danger ahead of you. So you have to actually, like, see the camera before you know that it's looking at the room. And that was one of the ways that we made it more difficult. But it makes it changes how you play. It's not just, you know, like, decreasing the margin of error. It actually changes how you play the game.
Yeah. And I can't wait to actually try that myself. I've been just playing on Expert, but, oh man, that definitely sounds very different in terms of design.
The killer on Expert Plus is that you can't attack guards face on. That in the Expert, if a guard is face to face, you can melee them still. That's the one that gets me off touch.
Yeah.
All right. Now, before we talk more about the advanced mechanics and design decisions of Invisible Ink, I have just one more general basic question for you guys. And that is regarding the procedural generate element of the game. Now, obviously, as you talked about over the last few minutes, Invisible Ink definitely has roguelike elements to it. And major part of roguelike design is creating a system that allows it to just create more and more levels, so you're not just playing the same things every time. Now, getting into the minute details of creating the procedurally generated engine may be a little too much for this cast, but in terms of overall, like, high-level thinking, how did you guys approach building this game with in a procedural manner?
I think the way you approach almost any procedural project is, like, okay, how can we get the system, how would we design a good level of Invisible Ink? And then, okay, how can we get this computer program to think in sort of the same way that we would design the level, right? How can we get it to, like, what's the logical process? Like, do we say, okay, I want a level that looks like this, I want to have interesting that, I want to have these things and sprinkled, you know, in a way. So it's sort of like taking your design process and boiling it down to logic that a computer can understand, and then trying to get the computer as close as possible to, you know, sort of building out interesting levels in the way that a designer would.
Okay. Okay.
And you had lots of iteration on that.
Yeah, lots of iteration on it.
Yeah,
we basically have like a maze generation algorithm that goes in and it partitions the level up into a bunch of rooms, and then it connects those rooms in a way that there's always a path to the exit. Mm-hmm. And then it goes in and puts stuff in the rooms in an interesting way. And interesting meaning, you know, like sort of the way a designer might.
Okay. And now I'm just curious, on the different Diffley levels, does that impact how the computer decides to build levels, or does it just use the same decision-making process regardless of what difficulty level the game is on?
There are a couple small differences. It depends on what you mean by... I guess it depends on what you're counting as building the level, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of stuff where it's like, okay, on a harder difficulty, it'll construct guard patrol paths differently, it'll also place guards differently in the first place. So guards are more spread out on easier difficulties, and they're more random on harder difficulties.
As far as like the architecture and like the location of safes and things, that's the same.
Yeah, all the pure architectural stuff is different. It's the same, but the guard stuff is different on harder difficulties.
Cool. Okay, I think with that, we're going to move on to talk about our next section. I know for those of you listening, we haven't talked too much about the design details of Invisible Ink, and that's because I'm going to save that for the following section of the cast. We're just going to put everything into that part. So before we talk more about the advanced details of Invisible Ink, there's one part of development that I want to dedicate some time to with you guys, and that is early access. One of the things about Clay as a studio is that you guys have really adopted early access as a form of game development and funding your titles. And we first saw this with Don't Starve a few years ago, back when early access was still very much high in public opinion. Now, over the last year and a half, things have definitely changed. And that was right around the time that you guys put Invisible Ink onto it. And it's definitely, the model itself has shown both pros and cons of game development. So my first question for you guys is, what attracted Clay to focusing a lot of their titles with early access?
Yeah, I think we really like getting user feedback in very mm-hmm. early process, and we don't want to spend a long, long time on a game that is sort of, you know, just self-congratulatory, like, oh yeah, you know, like, we're really liking it, so, you know, people are going to like it. We'd rather have, you know, the ability and the opportunity to change the game in ways that, you know, could save it from being, you know, maybe this just super niche title, and also could make it, you know, give us perspective on it that we don't have just working in the studio. So, yeah, I mean, I think we just genuinely thought this might be a better game if we got people in there and playing it and talking to us about it.
And that's probably true. What?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Now, in terms of putting Invisible Ink, and also with putting Don't Starve onto early access, in terms of when you actually do it, obviously, with Invisible Ink, it didn't immediately go into early access. You did do some development off of it. How did you guys decide when to officially put on early access and to let other people, you know, poke and prod it?
Well,
once we had like a complete loop of the mechanics, that was part of it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for a game to go on early access, it has to be fun and it has to be really polished. I think those are the two things.
And the reason, more polished than you expect. Yeah.
It's got to be really polished. And the mm-hmm. reason for that is because the vast, vast majority of people, including designers, basically anyone who you show the game to, will have not super useful comments if the game isn't polished.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just be too caught up with the bugs and the issues. And, you know, it's really hard to see past that stuff as a player. The feedback you'll get on the game is super useful, but only if you have this experience where people actually give you feedback on the stuff that is you know, you want to change, and not just the stuff that's broken, right?
Yeah, they're not being distracted by bugs.
Because you should be able to figure out how to fix the broken stuff.
Yeah.
So you fix the broken stuff, and then that actually takes a really long time to polish the game. And then you release it, and it has to, you know, you want to get feedback on the stuff that's more... you know, design and sort of like direction of the game and that kind of stuff. And you don't want to get feedback on like, oh, you know, this UI is broken, right? Because you're like, yeah, I know, like, I'm going to fix it. So it needs to be super polished to get useful feedback.
Okay. And you guys mentioned a few seconds ago that part of the reasons that Clay likes early access is that it allows you get your game in front of your audience, and it basically lets you get a lot of the feedback and design. As you said, you'll want to be developing this game in an echo chamber because obviously as developers, you know how everything's going to work. It's very hard to use that feedback to decide, you know, is something non-intuitive or is this too difficult? Whereas with the fan base, you do get, you know, a huge quantity and quality of voices looking at your title. In terms of that kind of fan reaction to the game, do you guys have any examples of like a major change or major plus that was added to Invisible Ink thanks to consumer feedback?
Yeah, I would say the entire flow of the game is majorly different because of early access. And I think the idea that we incorporated rewinds, level retries into the game is all because of early access. The multiple difficulty modes and options, including the campaign generation options, are because of feedback we received in early access. Sort of simplifying the game and making it intuitive and having a mechanics that people can understand and teaching them those mechanics. I think we would have had something much more obfuscated and obtuse if we didn't end up in early access.
Okay. Now, another part of early access, and this is a major part we see a lot of developers sometimes struggle with, is keeping the momentum going with the game. We see developers who put a game on early access and then they may not update it for months on end, or they'll release it and then they basically say, oh, we ran out of funding, game's done, you know, we're going to release it now.
Sure.
With you guys and the rest of Clay, how did you guys approach, I guess, keeping the momentum going with Invisible Ink over early access into the official release?
I think with Don't Starve, they were very, that was a big part of it for them, is they wanted to keep that momentum, and they had a 2-week update cycle, that seemed to do well as far as like the community went. And on Invisible Ink, we were like, okay, we would like to try and model that as well as we can as well. But just the games are a little different, and we were finding it quite difficult to maintain a 2-week update schedule for Invisible Ink. It's more difficult to just take an element, add it, throw it into the game. It's a little bit, there's more systems to be balanced that way. So we were challenged with that. I think we shifted to sort of a small 2-week and a big 4-week update. And that was sort of, we were testing out different strategies of how that was going to work. But it is an area I think that we're still evolving. We're trying to figure out like the best way to do it. Each game, I think, is different in that way.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think, we're very privileged as a company to be sizable, and you know, we have the Canadian government is very good at supporting independent developers, and also, you know, we're a big company. We have experience. We've done this before. So I think it's hard to really say like, all the people who just ran out of funding just need to do this, right? I mean, we have a lot of advantages those people don't have as developers.
We weren't really using the early access as a way to fund the game to get it launched. It was to put it in front of people to have them play it, test it, give us feedback on it.
And I don't think in general we would use early access to fund games.
Yeah, I don't
think it's not really the reason.
Man, that's a really good point there from both of you regarding the difference between using early access as a measuring or playtesting or using it as just funding for the game. Because when we see developers go the funding route, you're really leaving the game as a game. Because if a game doesn't earn enough money, guess what? You're going to end up with a game that's maybe only a quarter of the way done. Or if it turns into a huge success, then this game could become this amazing thing over 2 to 3 years' time. And probably the perfect examples of the plus and the negative of that would be comparing Prison Architect to Space-Based DF9 from Double Fun, and Introversion with Prison Architect. And now, Prison Architect has gone for over 2 years now of development and funding, and just has taken off, whereas Space-Based, they were, you know, betting the farm they were going to get, I think, 5 years of development funding on that game. They only got, like, 6-7 months. And then what happened was, of course, they ran out of money, and they had to say, oh, the game is done because we can't work on it anymore. And all this stuff we promised, guess what? You know, that's not going to happen.
That, I think the making promises, when you go into an early access thing, you're sort of saying, this is the game we want to make. What do you think? It is a dangerous place where you tell the public what you were wanting to do with it, and they can easily think that that's locked in. Yeah. Whereas when designing a game, it's, you can't really do that. You need to be a little bit more flexible and like, oh, this system's not working, so we're going to take that out and change it up. There's a danger at that.
Definitely really hard to present properly to the public. And it's something that we're always working on and making better. And it's just, you know, it's the balancing act of you want to be transparent, but you also don't want to promise people that,
exactly,
you know, we're just sitting here and we're like, what if we did this, right? And if people just had a camera on us all the time, then they would hear that and they'd be like, oh, they're going to do that. But it's not, right? We're not going to do any of those things. So, you know, you want to, it's a balancing act between trying not to overpromise to people and also trying to be transparent. And I think it's a genuinely difficult problem to solve. And I think, you know, DF9 had a hard time with it, but, you know, it is like super, super hard.
Yeah. And I want to touch on what you guys just said a few minutes ago regarding the update cycle for Invisible Ink versus Don't Starve, and how the 1 week or 2 week cycle just was very difficult for that game. That reminds me, I spoke with the developer Rage Squid a few months ago for their game Action Hank, and they had the same concerns or the same issues that you guys had, that doing like a 1 week or 2 week update cycle was just too strenuous. And as you guys said, when you're dealing with a game built around multiple systems, you know, just throwing in a new mechanic every week or every 2 weeks, it can just make things very haphazard and you don't have the time to fully integrate them. And they decided to go with the once a month major update thing, and that worked a lot for them. But I think from what you guys are saying that you're right that it really depends on the game and the systems. Like if you're doing a very basic mechanic or a very basic game where the mechanics don't change over time, then you could probably do a 1 week, 2 week update. But if you're doing something like on the scale as Invisible Ink where you have all these different systems interconnected, you really do need that extra time to make sure that this new mechanic properly flows with everything else in the game.
Yeah, that's what we found anyway for Invisible.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, we never really perfected it, I'd say.
Yeah.
I think we were still trying stuff at the very end about how to best do our updates. So excited, you know, if we do another early access game, then I think we'll still be testing.
At the end of Invisible Ink, we kind of took that risk of doing a very large update. And I mean, there was a risk of people fearing that we had, you know, just sort of closed up on it or abandoned it. And, you know, I think it worked out in our favor to like take that. We felt that we got the good feedback what we had, but now we needed that extra time to polish it. And I think that worked out for us, but that could have been a risk.
Yeah, the main thing we tried to do there was just be very transparent.
Yeah,
like, you know, a month ahead of time, hey, we're going to take a couple months to sit down and actually just crank out polish on this thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we kept reminding people. And so I think eventually, you know, as long as people genuinely understand what's going on and they're like, okay, that's a, like, I'll buy that. You know what I mean? I think that's actually happening. Then it seems all good.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, I just have two more early access questions and then we'll get back to talk about Invisible Ink itself. The first one is, another major part of like this crowdfunding phase that's going in the game industry is, of course, Kickstarter and going that route to fund games. Now, you guys did mention a few minutes ago that you use early access more for the testing and the consumer reactions as opposed to just pure on funding. And I was just wondering, do you think Clay will ever go down the Kickstarter route? Or do you think that you'll stick with this model and using early access to develop your games?
I have no idea.
We did use Kickstarter for our Chester toy.
Yeah, we used it for a plush.
Yeah.
Plush,
merchandise. My guess is that that's where we would be using Kickstarter. Right? I don't think we use it for game development.
Maybe. I mean, I think it totally depends on the game, right? I mean, I think if we see a game, we're like, okay, you know, we like making good games, and so that's our goal with any game. And so if we feel like, okay, Kickstarter is the best way we can make a good game, the most likely way this game will end up good is Kickstarter, then we'll go to Kickstarter. But, you know, I think just the variables are different, right? It's like, yeah, certain types of games work on Kickstarter, certain types of games work on early access, and just sitting down and having discussion about, okay, what's going to make this game the best game it can possibly be, you know, that might be Kickstarter, it might be early access, it might be not going into either of those things. I think it really just depends on what you want from the game, how long you want to work on it, and what kind of scope you have in mind, what kind of game it is.
Okay. Now, I just saw one other question on early access that I do really want to touch on. As I said at the beginning of this section, when you guys did Don't Starve, early access was still very much a positive part of Steam. There weren't really any issues with it. And then over the course of the last year or so is when we started run into quality control issues, the consumer confidence sort of took a dip there. As you guys were developing Invisible Ink and putting on the early access, were you guys worried at all about sort of the negative reception of the platform at the moment?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we definitely thought about it, but at the same time, we were like, you know, I think it will genuinely make it the best game it can be. So, you know, I think people will, I think we're always confident that people would see that we were not, you know, we were taking this seriously, and we were pretty sure that would shine through.
This was one of the first times on a game design where I had the level of responsibility I do. So the number of people we were getting in early access was a comfortable number for me. If it had blown up, I don't know what I would have done. So the fact that there, people were a little lukewarm on early access was okay for me.
Right. It also trickled in usage, right? So we had testing on, you know, the stuff. We didn't get a huge spike in the beginning. We actually had, you know, legitimate new users testing.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I have one final question regarding early access, and then we'll move on. That is for any developers listening to this cast who are interested in going the early access route. Do you guys have any tips regarding either something you really, really need to do to put your game on early access, and something that could be a red flag that you should avoid doing with your game while in early access?
I think we've mentioned two of them so far. One. Go out polished so that the feedback you're getting isn't blocked by people talking about the bugs and issues like that. And then the other one is, I think, be pretty transparent. Mm-hmm. Talk about what you're doing and why.
Yep, totally.
Okay. And any major red flags or something you should avoid doing with early access?
Don't not do this thing. No, I don't know.
Okay. Not a problem. All right. with that, let's get back to talking more about Invisible Ink. And for those of you listening to the cast, this is going to be the spoiler part of the cast, because we will be talking more about the mechanics and design decisions of the game. So if you haven't played the game yet, or you want to discover things on your own, this is the time to stop listening to the cast. So let's talk a little bit more on the heavy side about Invisible Ink. And to start off with, I guess this is a question I probably should have asked in the first section, and that is, in terms of the overall aesthetics of the game, how did you guys approach the art style that you wanted to have for the title? Because when I spoke with Nels about Don't Starve, I mean, that was a very interesting look at how his team put together Don't Starve's storybook-esque aesthetic.
We're kind of spoiled in the company. The artists are quite good here. So when we start making the game, we'll have, there'll be like a theme that the designers are thinking about, and the artists will start to take that theme and explore it in quite different ways. And then they can, you can kind of test within the office, you know, which one feels best. I know that Don't Starve went through a couple of different, like quite different art styles until it arrived at the one that it did. And that one, the artists are just very good at that. Coming up with different styles that can work with, but yet have different feels to them. And
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, so we ended up with sort of a combination of Neuromancer, like cyberpunk inspired stuff, and you know, sort of like 50s, 60s spy stuff. So it's sort of a Neuromancer cyberpunk aesthetic that uses a lot of color and you know, hard edges from 50s, 60s spy stuff. Mm-hmm.
Also got that almost Aeon Flux kind of like gangly look to it, which I think is also good.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about the art style, that's a good segue into talking about the agents themselves. In the game right now, I believe there's 10 agents plus their variants, is that right?
That's right.
And in terms of approaching the agents from an aesthetic, and we can actually talk more about their design as well, how did you guys decide on who the player would be controlling and their abilities and movesets?
You know, we wanted each agent to feel really spiky design-wise, so we ended up going with a lot of stuff that was like, you know, this. We want, if you start with this, you know, the agents are really in there for replayability. So if you start with this agent, we wanted it to be both like, okay, people will really like this agent from their aesthetic design and their story and everything. But at the same time, also playing with this agent will be actually a very, very different style of play. So we gave everyone augments and stuff that were really strong with the hopes that, you know, we can kind of balance everyone by making them equally strong, and then it's super interesting to play all the characters because they're strong in an interesting way. They're not just like, oh, this character gets +5 hit points or whatever. It's like, oh, you know, this character has a super, super different style of play from the get-go. So that was kind of the main approach I think we took, is just trying to go every angle we could with like, okay, what's a spike in this direction look like? What's a spike in that direction look like?
Okay.
One thing, at the beginning when the artists are like sort of drafting up character designs, you don't exactly know how many agents are going to, you know, make it into the game. You don't know how many very good distinct builds there's actually going to be. So they just did a number of them. And then as you go deeper into the project, you start to find out are we going to need more art for them, or do we have enough? And that, you just go by ear on that.
Okay. I like the idea, you know, I said that you approach it from spikes or going in very sharp directions with abilities and skills. And we saw that with some of the characters, like Dr. Zhu basically has the ability to knock out anything electronic for one turn, whereas someone like Nika can basically attack twice per turn and go in these different routes. In terms of actually balancing these characters out, how did you approach making sure that character was either not strong enough in a specific direction, or they weren't going far enough and they needed to be boosted?
We got pretty good at the game, so I think there was a certain point which we could intuitively just say, like, okay, we'll play with this character for an hour. Oh, okay, I think we have a pretty good idea of how strong they are. We need to bring them up to match Nika, or we need to lower them down to whatever. Mm-hmm. I think we got a pretty good eye, just over years of playing the game, we got a pretty good sense of, like, okay, we can just play this character for half an hour and get a good sense of their balance.
It wasn't like 100% important for me for them all to be exactly balanced either. That if there was, like, I didn't want them there to be like a drastic difference between them. But if one of the agents was a little weaker than another agent, then that becomes like sort of like winning with that agent is even more rewarding than another one. So they didn't need to be exactly balanced, but it's close was good.
And speaking about the agents and their various abilities, do you guys have any preferred agents that you like to take when you start a run?
I usually do like Shalem Banks, Shalem Prism.
I shift around. I was really with Banks International, and Nika and Zhu is really good. Yeah.
I like Shalem a lot because then all you need is like a little armor piercing on him, and he's quite kind of set for the rest of the game. I usually just end up with Shalem with like a gun, 4 ammo packs, and then like a piercing scan.
Shalem on Iron Man is quite good because if you don't have rewinds, he's kind of like your rewind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've really come around to Shalem in my last game because I usually approach things purely from stealth, but I finally decided to try him out with this gun, and he can really get you out of some sick situations if you get lucky.
Absolutely.
And he's really close at being really powerful. As you said, you get him a good gun with armor piercing, or you get him the mod that lets him kill without raising the alarm, and you can just really go to town on a level with him.
Yeah, totally.
I also really like Dr. Zhu, again, for his ability to just take out something for one turn. And he's one of those characters that his viability really remains throughout the entire game, just like Shalem or Nika with their abilities.
The Dr. Zhu has the potential to save you so much power, yet it's all dependent on you getting him into the right positions. So it's kind of a good balance there.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you guys I'm not sure when this happened, either early access or release, but you lowered Dr. Zhu's movement ability, which is the opposite of Decker, where he just naturally has 1+AP.
Yeah, totally. So it's just part of spiking the character. If we wanted to make him super strong, but then make him weak in other areas, right? It's sort of the balance that we chose was making them super strong in certain areas and then weaker in other areas to compensate.
Yeah, that's just us playing and realizing that, this EMP ability is pretty strong.
Now, over the course of the podcast, we've talked about balancing the game and giving the player challenges, and that takes us into talking about the actual enemy designs themselves. Now, what's interesting about Invisible Ink is that you have this core or this basic foundation of enemies or opposition in the form of the basic security cards and the cameras, and then you guys take things further with the different mega corporations and having them each have like their own little subtle touches. So you have one corporation that specializes in robotics, and another one that goes with more hacking or advanced soldiers and etc. How did you guys go about developing and balancing the various corporations, and then taking that a step further, getting down to the actual enemies or what the player will be dealing with?
I'd say we actually could probably have, it's an area that we could improve improve, or we do it again, maybe have done it differently. But we looked at ways that you could, you know, block the player, different things that could get in their way, and then you sort of sort them into categories. We also had these corporations that we were sort of building their characters and themes for. We're like, okay, which of these sets, which item, which corporation would this sort of barrier that we've come up with work well with? And it kind of organically developed into the four corporations. We had some idea, but they weren't like set in stone. And then as things went on, we were able to like solidify them a bit more. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe we could have done it better than we did.
I totally agree. I think that's actually one of the weakest parts of the game is there's like Senkaku that's got, like, Senkaku's super unique. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of them are sort of like, yeah, I can kind of go to, I mean, Plastic's got that one annoying guard, but it's like, yeah, you know, FDM Kano are pretty similar. Like, I feel like if we had more time and if we were going to go back and retroactively change something that we've done, I think we would have done a better job with making all four corps feel as unique as Senkaku feels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have liked to have done it.
Yeah, and I think that's also one of my little complaints with Invisible Ink, which I'll talk about in a few minutes when we talk about future content for Invisible Ink. Now, in terms of, I guess, as you said, with trying to figure out how to balance these guards out, was there any interesting balancing or design decisions regarding how dangerous to make the various oppositions?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the idea of guards getting stronger in the first place was really tough. You know, initially we just had the single one type of guard, and then we knew that we could have guards with, special abilities and stuff. But one of the problems we ran into was that just guards with special abilities wasn't, like, you could still get through the game without really having that many, like, gear checks. And also, you never felt like you were getting that much stronger because it was like, oh, I could have just done this level with my standard equipment. Mm-hmm. So we introduced the idea of armor, which is sort of just like, you know, oh, do you have armor piercing? And so it's another angle in which the guards get stronger. And it's kind of like, it feels good because then as a player, when you get armor piercing, it feels like, okay, now I'm at a point where I'm stronger in my campaign. So that really helped us get the feeling of guard difficulty leveling up and then your agents leveling up. But yeah, it took a while for us to get to a point where we were happy with how the guards were progressing in difficulty.
And I'm sorry, if you could just clarify for me, just because of the quality of the webcam, what corporation did you guys say that was sort of like the high mark of your development?
I would say Senkaku is the best corporation. I mean, it's got drones, right?
Okay.
It's got all that stuff that makes it super unique. Every time you go to a Senkaku level, it's super unique compared to the other ones.
Yeah.
People will often talk about Senkaku, and they know the corporation that has the drones, whereas like FTM and KNO. KNO is like the military corp, and FTM is kind of like your like mass big box store kind of. People won't really know. They'll talk about the guards in them. They don't really know which one was for which. They kind of blend together.
The subtleties, we went too subtle with the differences.
Okay, yeah.
One of them should have been like cyborgs, the other one should, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
In a perfect world, we would have gone back and changed that, gone in a time machine. But, yeah, totally.
Okay. Now, another part of the games we talked about is the 72-hour campaign structure and how that fit into the different mission types that you have. In terms of building the game up that way, how did you guys settle on what types of missions you wanted the player to go on over the course of their campaign?
It was partially how does your team get better, and what what paths does it kind of go down to get better? And so then you just give the different paths, those destinations you're going to go on. So one of the locations is about getting more programs for your computer. One of them is about getting more items. One of them is about more money. Mm-hmm. So it's just different ways that you would build up your team. It's kind of like your skill tree divided up into locations.
Yeah, and we also wanted the overall to have interesting decisions. So we ended up, you know, different locations take longer to get to or shorter to get to. So every time making a decision about where to go, you have to think about like how long does it take to get here? How hard is the level? Because different levels have different difficulties. And what corporation is it at, and what reward am I getting from it? So there's like a number of vectors to think about when you're choosing a mission, and that was very much intended when we were designing that system.
Yeah, but it kind of reminds me a lot of XCOM and how you had to pick and choose what missions you would go on and which ones you would basically let fall by the wayside. One quick mechanic question regarding that. Do missions disappear if you don't take them on, or is it like every 24 hours do the previous day's missions disappear?
No, they scale up. They get harder.
Yeah, they stick around and they get harder.
Okay. Now, you mentioned how you approach the mission design as sort of, as you said, like akin to building out a skill tree or going up and getting better and stronger. And that is a good segue into talking about the item and the program design. And let's start with the item, because Incognita is its own system in of itself. In terms of item development and balancing, I know you guys mentioned the armor piercing sort of as a progression model or a power model for making your character stronger. In terms of just designing these items, I know way back in the beginning of the cast, you said that one of the things you liked about this cyberpunk setting or this fancy setting was that it gave you leeway to, you know, put whatever you want in the game and then sort of build that around the future or the cybernetic lore. In terms of balancing these items and mechanics, how do you guys approach, you know, what kind of tactics or options you want the player to have with these items? Because there are quite a varied number of tactics. There's items that increase AP, items that give you additional armor piercing. There's even items that let you essentially copy Banks' ability to open locked doors. I think it was a crypto decoder or something like that.
You know, I would say in general that our game is very tight, and, you know, we don't have magic, we don't have elements, you know, we don't have combat in any significant way, we don't have damage and hit points, so our systems are very tight, actually, and the things that our items let you do are sort of the natural progression of those systems. We just sort of, we looked at what we have, we said, like, okay, what if you could bypass this, what if you could bypass that? What are interesting ways to subvert this expectation? And because our game is so tight, it was sort of like the items just sort of naturally came out of that. Like a cloaking rig is sort of obvious when you have, you know, like what if you have perfect stealth for a turn, right? That's a cloaking rig. What if you can bypass the firewalls on something, right? That's an EMP. What if you don't break the firewalls if you're next to it? That's a buster chip, right? So there were kind of a lot of items that just sort of came naturally. And then I would say the other ones were sort of just gadgety, right? We were like, okay, what gadgets are cool and what particularly allows for emergent play and also just does stuff that, you know, could maybe interact with the systems in a way that we didn't intend when we made the item. So we're sort of looking around for sort of items that would create emergent situations and cool stuff that we didn't initially, you know, think of when we were designing it.
Okay. And did you guys use that same approach when you were deciding on the augments or passive abilities you could put onto the character?
Yeah, same kind of looking at what areas the player might want to improve upon on their agents, and it's kind of like skills for their agents. Very similar to that.
Trying to get combos, emergent combos, and stuff like that. You know, it's trying to make turns that are super interesting, and also trying to do the same thing we do with the characters, which is spike everything and make it all like fun to use.
Synergies, items that will you know, have benefits with other items in combination is something we were looking at as well.
Yeah, I think the example we brought up earlier was the Shalem 11 and getting him the anatomy analyzer or giving him additional armor piercing and just really building him up that way.
Right.
And it's interesting about that approach because, as you said, by building these characters and these items around these spikes, it does allow you to come with items that can push things further. As you said, create these very interesting synergies, which is another staple of tactical design or strategic design. Getting back to talking about Incognita, that is another major part of the game. For those of you who haven't played it, Incognita allows you to use programs that can either hack electronic devices or mess with things on the level. You could ping areas and cause guards to go explore and whatnot. With this type of hacking design or mechanic, was this something that you guys wanted from the very beginning, or did this, like, how did this come about during development?
So very early in the game, like from the, like, probably the earliest versions of it as a heist sort of game, it had this like network hacking part of it. But it went through many iterations before it got where it was. I mean, at the start, it was just very, very simple. We sort of layered things on. And I think at a couple points, it was like way too complicated. Eventually it came down to it. Or at one point, you would have a computer system in the world and that would be linked directly to another, sort of security defense. So you had wanted to shut off a laser. You had to go and find a particular computer. That didn't work very well with procedural generation because then it meant that it was very complicated in how it would have to get set up. So then we went to this, well, any computer will give you power and you use that power to interact with any device. And we had that for a while, but it almost was too simple. And so We just iterated back and forth by making it a little bit more complicated or less complicated until we found it.
In terms of developing the various programs or options, how did you guys approach Incognita's abilities in the world?
Hugely inspired by Netrunner.
Yes.
Sure. Big fans of Netrunner, the card game.
Yeah.
That was a huge inspiration. And then building off that, I think we just, you know, same thing again. We kind of put the natural paths. We had one that was like weak but steady, and then we had one that was fast but, you know, had a long cooldown. We had one that, you know, broke a lot but cost a lot, so it was overkill. Mm-hmm. And then we had one that was like, you know, sat on a thing for a while and broke it slowly. So we took all the different possibilities, and then I think we really only have maybe like 5 or 6 programs in there that aren't like standard archetypes, you know, like we have a lot of programs that are just like, this is the big one, this is the small one, this is the middle, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a lot of that. So, and then we have a couple programs that aren't standard. So if we ever do expand the game, I think that would be one of the directions we take it, as more interesting programs probably. But yeah, we basically just kind of went with what made sense initially.
Okay. And speaking about Incognita, and this actually goes back to enemy design, there's also the daemons that can show up as you get later in the game, and these things can just really mess with you or mess with the levels. There are some that take your money, reduce your AP, or even spawn additional guards. With the overall design of the daemons, how do you guys approach these essentially landmines for the player to avoid?
Yeah, the daemons were awesome. When they came in, it was like a huge turning point.
Yeah.
For the game, because before that, you would kind of just hack stuff every time you'd see it. You just see a thing and you'd hack it, and you just do that for the entire level. And daemons made it so it was always an interesting decision, because, you know, maybe you'll have to save some of your power for that daemon later on, or get around it or whatever. It gave texture to the hacking decisions. And then with the actual design of the daemons themselves, we just tried to make it so none of them felt like they were unfair. They felt like they were strong and painful, but they didn't feel like, you know, I couldn't have possibly dealt with that any other way. You know, it always felt like, kind of hopefully it always felt like you could get around hacking a daemon, or at least get a deal with the effect of it pretty effectively.
Something I really like in games, a game I used to love when I was younger was Space Hulk, the board game. And the thing I liked about it was that you have your perfect plan and it would always fall apart at some point. And it was always about how you recover and a new plan. And that's where the daemons really come in, is that they mess up something, but now you have to work around that problem. So that's really good.
Okay. Now, this next part, for those of you listening, is definitely going to be spoiler territory. And I want to talk briefly about ending the campaign of Visible Ink. Now, in the Early Access version, you guys had the quote-unquote end of the Early Access build was an escort mission. And then in the final version, we have this final grand mission involving a unknown corporation, their own super abilities. In terms of approaching ending the campaign, how did you guys decide on what did you want the final test of the game to be?
You know, I think we just knew it had to be really tough, because it had to be something that you were actually building up to, or else the rest of the game doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew it had to be tough, but yeah, I mean, I think we knew it was just going to be something that kept you on the level for a while, that forced you to use all your sneaking, that brought in difficult situations for you to deal with, lots of difficult stuff for you to deal with, without being, you know, overly difficult and overly kind of like kill you. You know what I mean? Like, we weren't going to send like 50 guards and like block a big hallway or whatever.
Yeah, more guards. Just as I said, didn't necessarily make it more fun. So that there were some routes that we didn't really want to try and go down.
Yep, totally. So yeah, I mean, we just knew it had to be a tough challenge, but also be something where what we tried to do with it was make it so that you felt like you were going to lose, but then you won. I think that was the goal for the final mission. So, I mean, you know, it's somewhat successful depending on the playthrough and the person and the procedural generation.
Okay. Now, have you guys thought about adding any other, like, I guess I wouldn't call them set levels, but missions that are built around a very specific objective, like the final mission with getting Incognita uploaded?
We had some in there. It was one of the things we were working on. I think that with the procedural generation, with the like replaying, if you keep seeing those missions over and over again, they really lose the qualities that make them good. So I think we decided that wasn't really the best route to go.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, before we get to our final topic then for this cast, are there any parts of Invisible Ink's design that I didn't cover that you guys want to briefly touch on?
Not really.
Okay.
We've done a lot of them. I do like how in a lot of tactics games, your teams can get really big, whereas we kept it kind of small. I guess the New XCOM well also did keep it small. And so your turns are pretty rapid. So sometimes when I'm playing, I kind of forget that I'm playing a turn-based game, and it feels a little bit more like a real-time game, just how, you know, quick turns move.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. And I'm just trying to remember, as you said, with most tactical games, when you start having, like, 16, 70 troops, it just really bogs down the turn order. I remember, like, the original XCOM ran into that problem. But with Invisible Ink, as you said, with just having a total of 4 agents per level, it does keep things moving at a very crisp, I'm sorry, a very quick pace.
Yeah. In fact, sometimes I'll not go and rescue more agents. I'll just keep it at the 2 just because that's a comfortable number.
Yeah, it's more fun to play stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, so with that, let's move into our final topic then for this cast. It's been really great talking to both of you. I'm sure we could talk for the next 2-3 hours, but I'm sure you guys are busy at Clay right now. So for the final topic then, I want to talk about the future. One thing that Clay has sort of made a little MO of themselves, especially with Don't Starve, was on future content and support of the game. With Invisible Ink, has there been any plans yet, or have you guys decided on future development for the title now that it's officially out?
I think it's really close to launch, and we're just still sitting on it, thinking about what's the best way to work with it, and you know, what do we want? What does the community want? What do we have time for? What are our resources? So I think it's a little close to launch to figure out exactly what we're doing next.
Yeah, it'll be good to over the next, you know, I don't know, week or something like that, to see what the community, how they really feel, and what they're asking for, what they would like to see more.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I think this is a good time to mention sort of what I would like to see. And this sort of brings me into one of my little complaints about the game, at least right now. As you guys said, with the corporations, at the moment, they're not too, other than Sengoku with the drones, they're not too specialized. And no, they're not too different. And my complaint of the game, at least for right now, is I would love to see more elements to sort of flesh out the experience and make things a lot more different each time. And the example that I like to bring up would be the expansion to XCOM Enemy Unknown from Firaxis, and how they just added in a bunch of supplemental content that didn't necessarily add hours to the game, it just added more options that can show up in an individual campaign. And I think, as you guys said, with the procedural element of the game and how it's built around this core or this set time, that having more ways to flesh that out, I think, would be a good step forward.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right. Now, obviously, there's a lot of different areas that you can go. We got, as you said, with the corporations, items, agents, and whatnot. And I know it is still very early, as you just said, in terms of talking about that. Are there any elements that were left on the quote-unquote cutting room floor that could possibly make their way back into the game, either agents, corporations, or anything like that?
We didn't cut a whole lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Majorly, the thing we cut was kind of like random FTL-style random events.
Yeah, we call them incidents. Yeah, that was cut.
But that's really the only big thing that I think we left on the floor. I think it's tough because, you know, a lot of the feedback is very different. Like, what you're saying is kind of the opposite of what other people are saying also, which is, they wanted a longer story, they wanted more stuff. So those things are kind of diametrically opposed, right? Adding variation versus adding length.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there are a lot of interesting things that people are saying about the game.
James has often said that the game's in, like, this weird space of how long it takes to finish the game. That, like, there's a lot of the newer roguelike games, like FPL, the gameplay experience is, like, 2 hours and a half or so. And then you have a game like XCOM where you finish it in 40 hours.
Yeah.
Our game is in to finish a campaign, it's like 6 hours or so if you're taking your time. And it's a little further than people who want to play an FTL game are feel like, you know, like that's what they want. And then yet it's much shorter than than the people who want that. Like, I want to create an agency which I'm playing for 40 hours with.
Totally, but yeah. I don't think it's fundamentally bad either.
No.
I think it's more a question of taste.
Yeah, it's just, it's in this weird spot though. Yeah.
I hope that this link is that we've given some people the taste for this this unusual timeline.
Yeah.
And speaking about like the exciting campaign, that was actually another point that I would love to see. As you said, it's sort of stuck right now between being this set 72-hour campaign versus the endless mode. Another thing that I would love to see would be making that endless mode a lot more complete. As you said, like actually trying to run this agency and build it up from the ground up would be another interesting way. But
totally. I mean, I think we're interested in that as well. But you know, that to me seems probably not the way to go, at least initially, just because this is a subset of our players. And I think, you know, if we do end up adding content to this game, it's going to be stuff that we really want everyone to experience.
And again, it's very interesting, as you just said, the game is definitely stuck. It's like in that caught between two masters type thing, between being a short 2-3 hour experience versus going, you know, the distance with endless run, and you know, who knows how long someone could actually play the game for, getting, you know, 20-30 days into it type deal.
Yeah, totally. I think there are people who have, you know, there's a decent chunk of people who are, you know, have sort of acclimated to that. And are more comfortable saying like, oh, okay, like I do like the fact you can play like a 5 hour or like a 3 hour playthrough of this game, and I do it, you know, one night, and then I complete a playthrough. It's not really like FPL where I complete like 3 or 4 playthroughs a night or something. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't consider it necessarily bad. I just think it's a new taste.
Definitely. And I guess one of my last questions, and for you guys, again, this probably may be a little too soon to tell, but I know with Don't Starve, I remember, I think when I spoke to Nels, that you guys originally had like 6-7 months planned to continue working on the game, and then that would basically grow or change based on the feedback. With Invisible Ink, are you guys setting any kind of time frame like that, or is it still too soon to tell in terms of overall impressions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Invisible Ink definitely isn't Don't Starve. That's the one thing I think we know, is that it's not like a sandbox survival game that we feel like we're going to update the same way we updated Don't Starve. You know, and whether or not we decide to change stuff in Invisible Beyond Hotfixes and how we decide to do that is still, I think, totally up in the air. But yeah, it's definitely not Don't Starve.
Okay, I think with that, this has definitely been a great cast. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you. But I think I am just about out of questions. And again, we could sit here and talk casually for the next 2-3 hours. But I'm sure you guys are very busy. And, you know, I don't want to hold you guys up any longer. So, with that said, for both of you, my final question then is, do you guys have any either final thoughts regarding talking about Invisible Ink, or anything you would like to say to the fans listening? I'm basically going to give you guys, like, the floor is yours for the next minute or so.
Sure. Yeah, thank you so much for having us on. It's a blast. Great questions. Really well thought out. Definitely really enjoyed being here. And of course, thank you to everyone who's listening, thinking about the game, talking about the game, and you included. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really thankful for all those people we had some big dedicated fans who gave us excellent feedback on the forums during the early access. It's really good. I'm very happy that we were able to finish the game and glad that we were able to have like the 3 months of polish before we launched it, so that everyone can enjoy the full experience, like the new fresh experience. I look forward to seeing people posting their scores, their net worths, when they finish Expert Plus.
All right. So I think with that, we're going to end things here. A great way to end things. Jason, James, again, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks
for having us.
Yeah, not a problem. And as I said at the beginning, definitely congratulations to both of you and to the rest of the team at Clay for Invisible Ink. And I really can't wait to see what comes out of Invisible Ink over the next few months. And, you know, whatever the hell next coming out of Clay overall.
Cool. Thank
awesome.
You.
Thank you.
All right. All right. So for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for the cast. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a guest on a future podcast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted. and to contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure some very much needed monthly funding to keep the site going, pay the bills, and keep putting out this great content. You can find the Patreon information under the Patreon banner on the top of the front page. And you can find me on Patreon under Josh Beister or Game Wisdom. Any donations would be greatly appreciated to keep things going. And lastly, if you like to watch my daily Let's Plays and live streams of games, you can find me on Twitch under GW Beister. I'm usually streaming around 10 or so Eastern, and that all gets put on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, which I believe there should be a link here, or you can just find it on there under Game Wisdom. Again, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning in. We will talk to you real soon with some more interesting conversations about game design in the industry. Take care, everybody.